said, ignoring my question. I hadn't slept for nearly a day, but I doubted I could sleep any time soon. Not now. Certainly not on a horse. Samuel was watching me like a lost boy hidden behind a strong jaw and flowing mane. He might think of himself as a fierce warrior, but I saw a gentle and lonely man in desperate search of himself. Not unlike me. Until that moment, I hadn't realized how fond I'd become of him in such a short time. The sentiment surprised me. I guided my horse over to his and reached for his hand. I have to go with him. You must know that. Whatever's happening is beyond both of us. But I'll never forget you, Samuel of Hunter. We will meet again.
I will find you, he whispered. They are coming, Talia said.
He'd maneuvered his mount beside my own, and I turned, thinking I would mount Talia's second horse and leave Razor for Samuel. But I never made it that far. Talia was there, and his hand was there, at my chin, then over my eyes.
Dream,
he whispered. The word echoed through me and carried me away. I felt my slumping toward him as my consciousness faded, and then I was dreaming. Chapter 10 I dreamed a dream that wasn't a dream, and in that reality I guessed that I was sleeping on a horse, somehow secured so I wouldn't fall, riding due east behind Talia, an older man who had the stamina of the lion that trotted ahead of us. And then I was waking up to the sound of birds chirping outside my window, the same birds I always heard when I woke up, usually between 7 and 8 in the morning, just as the town began to come alive. I was back in Eden. I opened my eyes and slowly looked at my room, the drawn curtains glowing blue in direct sunlight, the Apple computer on my desk, the white ceiling and its orange peel texture. One of the few surfaces in the house I hadn't touched. But now I didn't need to touch to see, or click. I could see because a man named Vlad Smith had come into town yesterday and sent me into a coma where Justin had healed me. I was living in two realities that were somehow connected and directly affected each other. And by all accounts, I would throw both worlds into crisis. I lifted my hand and looked at my right forefinger. The tiny pinprick Vlad Smith had administered was still there. Slowly, like a descending fog, dread settled over me. I sat up in bed and stared around the room. Something was going to cost me everything. Yesterday had been the best day of my life. Today, I was afraid today would be different. I threw the covers off, slid out of bed, and stood up, dressed in yellow pajamas printed with little white bunnies. It all felt off. Wrong. Very wrong. Dad? His voice came back from the front of the house.
In here, honey. Just fixing us some eggs.
I had to tell him. It only took me a minute to strip out of the ridiculous pajamas and throw on a pair of jeans. Pulling open my closet, I was greeted with the sight of a dozen shirts, all black. Might have to change that. But in that moment, they could have been a dozen different colors, and I would have grabbed the closest without caring. Bacon and eggs were sizzling by the time I'd brushed my teeth and hurried out into the kitchen.
Morning, sweetheart. My dad grinned.
He kissed my hair and stepped back, spread his hands.
Well?
Well what?
You. I mean, you're not clicking.
My sight. I was no longer as taken with my sight as he was, but then I'd just spent a full day seeing in my dreams. Then again, if Justin was right, the whole world was blind, including me.
Still good, I said. Don't worry. My sight's not going to revert. No, of course it won't. He stepped over to the frying pan and scooped the eggs and bacon onto two green plates. The scent and sight reminded me of my hunger. I'd eaten nothing but strips of jerky and stale bread. No, that was in another world. But there is something else I need to talk to you about, I said. Sure, have a seat. He set the plates on the breakfast bar and crossed to the coffee pot. Big day today. Something's going down on the West Coast. No one's saying what it is, but all the major networks are offline and the internet is down. I glanced at the muted television, grayed out with static. Words scrolled across the screen, but of course I hadn't learned to read with my eyes yet. Something about a loss of signal, I guessed. Cell phones still work, but I tried to connect with my sister in Seattle and couldn't get through. Probably on her end. Coffee?
Sure.
I walked over to the breakfast bar and scooted my stool out. None of that upsets you? He brought two cups of coffee to the bar, mine with a little puppy on a big white mug. How could I be upset? My daughter can see. We live in a protected environment with all the power and food we need. I have all I need right here.
He stroked my hair.
Until they start rappelling over the cliffs with automatic weapons, I said. Well, it's not going to come to that. And if it does, we're prepared, aren't we? He meant the weapons the Council had stockpiled. But his willingness to even consider using them was news to me. I let it go.
I suppose we are.
Sit. I sat. Eat. I picked up a piece of bacon and bit into it. So what's on your mind? He asked, lifting his coffee. More bad dreams?
Not exactly. Not bad, I mean. Depending on how you look at it. But it might sound a bit crazy.
Tell me. Nothing sounds crazy to me anymore.
So I told him everything. Beginning with my waking in the desert and meeting Justin before the Horde came. Samuel's rescue of me, our encounter with Jacob at the Oasis, and being taken by Talia. Everything except the bit about me bringing a great crisis. And the five seals. He asked me polite questions as I rushed through tales of white bats called Roush, and black ones with red eyes called Shiitake, and Horde, and albinos. And I knew he was thinking it was all in my mind, a fear of losing my sight. But I just wanted to get it all out.
And that's it? He asked when I was done.
That's it.
He set down his empty cup and faced me. Speaking as a psychologist, I think it's a good sign.
A sign?
Think about it. These are the first lucid dreams you've had, right? The first time you've been aware that you're dreaming while you're dreaming, and you have some control in those dreams.
Yes, but
rather than being a victim of nightmares in which you have no clue you're in a dream, you're now lucid in those dreams.
This is fantastic.
Whatever happened in your mind to correct your blindness also might have shifted your dreaming patterns. Naturally, you're still contending with the fear of blindness, but these dreams could very well signal the end of your nightmares.
I think you might be missing the point. What about Thomas Hunter?
What about him? The whole world knows about his role in stopping the Ryzen strain 10 years ago. You know it too. And now it's entered your dreams. Perfectly understandable.
I shook my head. No, it's more than that. We don't even know how I regained my sight. Something else is happening. Tell me again what Vlad Smith said in my room at the hospital.
My father shrugged, but his eyes were fixed on the wall. Sight to the blind. Religious nonsense.
But not nonsense to me. And?
I suspect he's somehow connected to Simon, who isn't telling us everything.
Eyes on me.
But it's got nothing to do with you.
Okay, what else? He knew all about me. So what else did he say? About me?
That he needed to earn our trust by doing what he did with you.
And?
That's it. That you were the key.
He said that? Like the key to a door?
An idea struck me.
Or a gateway?
I took it as the key to getting the town behind him in correcting whatever he thinks is wrong. As far as what part he played in your spontaneous remission, it's impossible to say without knowing more. The mind is a powerful thing, and completely reprogrammable.
It is indeed. The voice came from behind us, and we both twisted in our seats. A tall man dressed in black slacks and a white jacket stood in our doorway, hair slicked back, thumbs hooked in his pockets. My father hadn't breathed a word of what Vlad Smith looked like, but I knew I was looking at him. And the moment I saw him, a chill rode up my spine.
"Forgive me, but the door was open," he said.
Without looking, he shoved the door closed with his heel. It slammed shut.
"Smith," he said, eyeing me. "Vlad Smith. So happy to finally be seen by you, Rochelle. Glad to have been of help."
My father was on his feet. Smith's eyes cut to my soul, and I suppressed the urge to run. I can't say I recognized him as Shadow Man, because things are different in nightmares than in real life, but he gave me the same feeling. Then again, this was the man who'd somehow facilitated my waking in another world. Why? Samuel suggested that I, as the 49th, had opened a gateway to that world. If so, did Vlad Smith intend to use me? To what end? Vlad interlaced his fingers, cracked his knuckles, and stepped to the center of the kitchen.
"You have to forgive me for being so direct with you yesterday, David. But as I'm sure you can now appreciate, Rochelle needed me."
"Fair enough." My father looked uncertain.
"I know this has all been a bit of a shock to both of you, so I've come to set the record straight before I illuminate the rest of the town. You want to know how I did it, right?"
My father found his voice.
"That would be helpful, yes."
"Maybe we could begin with a thank you," Vlad said, still fixated on me. My father hesitated.
"Thank you. You are so welcome, my dear."
But I wasn't the one who'd thanked him. He pressed his hands together and bowed his head as if praying to me.
"I must say, your mind's an enviable work of wonder. To think all that tissue up there, folded in on itself, packed with neurons and energy, it can do so much with the right programming. Amazing.
I like to call the human organism a tissue top." He pointed at his head.
"It's just tissue in there. Algorithms. In fact, all organism is algorithm. You have to go beyond tissue to find more."
The more he talked, the less I liked him.
"So how did you do it?" my father asked.
"Yes, of course." He spread his arms wide.
"How on earth did I manage to give Rochelle her sight back?"
"Yes, how?" I asked, daring to be heard. He flipped his jacket back and shoved a hand into his pants pocket.
"It's quite simple, really, when you understand polarity." "You do understand polarity, David?"
"Of course."
"Plus and minus. What goes up must come down. Electrons and protons, good and evil, angels and demons. All of it. Every action creates an equal and opposite reaction. The world of expression we all love and hate so much. All romance, all war, all religion, all life, all existence. He swept his free hand wide. The entire universe is built upon and depends on polarity. Fair statement?
Fair enough.
True statement? My father nodded once.
True.
Cause and effect. In both scientific and religious terms, we call it the law. He stopped, as if he'd given us a complete answer for my sight, though it was no answer at all. He took a deep breath and shifted his eyes over my head, looking into the distance. When he spoke again, his voice was softer.
But what if there was a way beyond polarity? What if you could escape the matrix of cause and effect that holds us all hostage? Anything would be possible, right? In God talk, we call it grace. The law says that if you step out of a boat at sea, you'll sink.
But grace says you're not bound by those laws, and you can actually walk on water. Yes? We both stared at him, unsure what he was getting at. I'd never heard anyone describe the workings of the world in those terms.
You're saying Rochelle's recovery was miraculous?
My father said.
That's your explanation?
Vlad wagged a finger.
Too much baggage, David. Let's not use words smothered in centuries of muddy dogma. Let's just stick with escaping polarity. All it takes is opening your mind to the belief in something other than polarity.
Belief, like a placebo, which is a very weak version of the kind of belief I'm talking about. If you truly, truly, truly believe that something has happened, it manifests. Whatever you ask, believing it has been done, it will be done. Isn't that what he taught?
Who?
My father asked.
Jesus, I said.
That's right, Rochelle. Bravo. As a man of God myself, it comforts me to know that even 2,000 years ago, someone got it right. Of course, he was rather special.
But Smith wasn't a man of God, I thought. He was a viper in God's clothing.
The point is, the power of belief is far greater than what science has yet confirmed. They're getting closer with all of their dabbling in quantum physics, entanglement, superposition, all of that basic stuff. But science still lags behind what the mystics have known for millennia. Either way, you'll eventually figure out how consciousness works to change the physical world. My ears burned at his mention of mystics.
So enlighten us,
my father said.
I'm trying, David. Give me a minute.
The world is changing through thought and belief alone. This whole valley, for instance, exists as it does only because you believe it is the way it is.
He tapped his temple with a long finger. Tissue tops.
In some ways, my father had already taught me much of this, using completely different terms. The body manifests what the mind believes to be true. Quantum physics went further, demonstrating that our consciousness directly affects all material manifestation, including the world around us. It was a law that somehow governed the entire universe, though no scientist knew why or how, only that it did.
Drop the God talk, and it will make more sense,
my father said.
But it makes sense to Rochelle, doesn't it,
49th?
It's him. This is Shadow Man, come in the flesh.
The moment I thought it, the faint scent of dirty socks masked by vanilla seeped into my awareness, and I swallowed, fighting back a terrible fear. He was using his God talk as a form of manipulation to gain my confidence, speaking truth, although I doubted he was any part of it himself. He paced, stroking his chin.
What if I could give you a demonstration, right here? Prove the power of belief right in front of your eyes.
Quicker than I could follow, Vlad took one step toward the counter,
grabbed something I couldn't see, spun around, and threw it at me. Everything in the room seemed to stall for a moment. I saw the object in flight, as if we were in a movie and someone had hit the slow motion button. And then the apple reached me, an inch from my mouth. It stopped there because my hand was already around it. I had reacted without thinking. My father took a step back, stunned.
How? What was that?
That was your daughter, knowing that she can do what cannot be done. Vlad said, go on, take a bite. Fingers trembling, I set the apple on the counter. Vlad looked at me, supremely satisfied.
I'll get to the story of how your wife was a victim of the law in just a moment, David. But my wife, what do you know about her?
Vlad lifted a finger.
But first, indulge me for just one more minute.
He pulled out a very old-looking book with a brittle leather cover and held it between his fingers. At first sight of that book, I felt my heart crash into my throat. A book of history?
Now, let's pretend that this book has magical power. I mean, really, really pretend. For just a few minutes, let's become like little children and really believe.
He stepped around the breakfast bar so he was facing us. May I? Without waiting for a response, he gingerly placed the book down in front of me.
Now, as children, we will treat this book with reverence.
His voice was laced with gravity.
Very few people have ever laid eyes on, much less written in, such a book. The truth is, whatever you pen in this book actually happens.
His words pulled at me. Did he know that I knew what the book was? I doubted it. Vlad pulled a long black pen from his pocket and laid it down on the counter.
Let's pretend that by placing Rochelle's blood in this book, he said, pulling the cover open to a blank page, I opened a gateway that allowed her to enter a dream world where she could see, a dream so powerful that it was real to her. With that power of belief, her mind self-corrected, and when she woke up here, she could see.
We didn't need to pretend. That was exactly what had happened. Why he'd pricked my finger. He had a book of history from the other world, but only my blood could activate it. Had activated it.
Today let's try something new.
Vlad was speaking the words as if too much force would shatter them.
Today, you will take the pen and write me into that same world. In our story, only you can do it, because only you have entered that gate. Do this, and we'll see what happens.
Yes, that would be a good thing. If I don't, he's going to blind me. I lifted my eyes and stared into his, pools of urgent mystery that drew me in a way I couldn't explain. He slid the open book closer to me.
Give it a try. I gave you my sight. Now you give me yours.
I blinked. It took some effort to shift my eyes away from his and back down to the page, and the moment I did, my intention to write anything about him in the book collapsed. But I was still afraid, and I had to know if I had the kind of power everyone in the other world was saying I had. So I placed my hand on the page. A vibration like a current rode up my arm, and I jerked my hand away.
You okay, honey?
My father asked. He reached over and touched the book, flipped the corners of a few pages with his thumb.
Seems harmless enough.
As the pages flipped, a dark smudge on one of them caught my eye.
Harmless,
I said in a thin voice, but my fingers were shaking. Vlad had picked up the pen and was holding it out to me.
Go ahead. Use your own words. Just write me into that dream world. Who knows? Maybe I'll vanish right in front of your eyes.
My father cleared his throat. He wasn't buying any of it. I peeled back the pages to the one with the marking. There at the top of the page was a smear of blood. My blood. I was right. He'd used my blood with the book to open the gate for me. I could now use it to send others through. But my eyes were immediately drawn to the thin 4-inch circle in the middle of the page, a circle like the one on my arm. Inside of that circle was a white band about a 1/2 inch wide. In the center of the circle were written these words, "What begins as white that man has made black?" I was reading with my eyes. How was that possible? My heart skipped a beat. "It's a riddle," I whispered, thinking of Talia's instruction to look for words that pointed to the first seal. "A riddle? It looks like blood," my father said. He looked at Vlad. "Rachelle's blood?" Vlad ignored him. His breathing had thickened. "A riddle, you say? You see words?" Neither of them could see the circle, or the words. "What begins as white that man has made black?" This was it. A riddle that would lead me to the first seal of truth. I knew it in my bones. I touched the page, then ran my hand over the words, feeling for the slight indentation all writing made. All but this writing. The page was perfectly smooth. "I don't think I will write in the book," I said, removing my hand and looking up. "But can I keep it?" A momentary rage, blacker than midnight on a starless night, gripped Vlad's face and was gone so quickly I wondered if I'd imagined it. He picked up the book and put it back into the inner pocket of his jacket. "It came from the mountains of Moldavia. A sentimental affair."
"I think you've made your point," my father said.
"No." Vlad walked around the bar and faced us from the center of the kitchen. He showed no sign he'd hit a wall with me. "Not yet, I'm afraid. But I had to give the easy path a try. Sooner or later, I'll work the truth into your thick skulls. For your sakes, I vote for sooner. This is only a foreshadow." He headed for the door. If there was any doubt lingering in me, his last words sealed the truth of his identity. He probably knew more about the 49th than I did, and he needed me to write him into the book. To what end, I didn't know. And why was I the 49th, I didn't know either. In fact, most of what I knew right then was that I was terrified of being blinded again, subject to his ravaging nightmares.
"And my wife?"
my father asked. Vlad turned back, hand on the knob.
"Your wife, David, was murdered because she, like the daughter she birthed, was special. Her mind wasn't fit to cope with the laws of Eden, but I would walk very carefully with that fact. Barth isn't one to mess around with."
And then Vlad Smith opened the door, stepped outside, straightened his jacket, and walked away, leaving the door wide open. Chapter 11. Jacob, son of Kurong, supreme ruler of all Horde, stood in the thrall overlooking Kurongi City, so named by his father when he crushed the albinos who lived in this forest. The Horde had drained the Red Lake and cleared the trees to make room for the thousands of homes now spread out before them. On his right stood his father, Kurong. To his left, Bael, whom Jacob despised. His mother, Patricia, ever the fussing worrier, had suggested they ignore the High Priest's call for an immediate audience upon his return less than 2 hours earlier. You know he will tear you apart with all his foul words, she'd cried. Does he rule here? Is the city named after him? She paced in a long, flowing lavender robe. Her light gray skin was smoothed with morst, a perfumed paste the wealthy wore to ease the annoying pain of the cracking skin common to all horde. Strange how the albinos called them scabs. To think the vision of beauty before him could be called a scab was preposterous. Like the moon draped in regal linens, she floated over the polished stone floor. "No, mother," he said, slightly amused by her fear of Bael. "But I do have charge of the throaters. Our charge is to Bael, no matter how absurd his antics. What kind of man would I be to cower from my duty?" "Refusing to go is not to cower. It's to let that scoundrel know whose son you are." "Which is why I will always go when Bael calls me, to let him know who I am." She scowled. "If you would stop this ridiculous nonsense of chasing down phantoms who present no threat and spend more time accepting the advances of women, you too would have a son." "Is that what you think of me? A warrior concerned only with albinos? Do you forget my songs, my dancing late into the night with women hoping to be swept away by the son of Kurong?" "Then take one," she cried, slapping the tabletop next to her. An apple toppled from the bowl, rolled off the table, and landed on the ground. So the truth of her fussing about had finally surfaced, as it always did. "Must you steer every conversation into this? Is it wrong for a queen to long for a grandson to love?" she demanded. He wondered if he would ever find a woman as spirited as she. "Never fear, mother," he said, finishing his meal and wiping his hands. He rose and kissed her on the cheek. "I only wait for one who knows true love. Until then, I will play my role as the finest warrior in all the land." He started for the door, then turned back. "This albino we seek. Bael sent me after her because she bears a mark on her shoulder, a mark never seen on any other albino in his dungeons."
"And what should this mark mean to me?"
"Did you know she claims to be the 49th mystic?" His mother's face froze like porcelain.
"Nonsense," she finally said. "Absurd."
"I don't know. I found myself oddly affected by her."
"In what way? She casts spells?"
"Nothing so superstitious. I just..." "She believes it. Somehow, I do as well." He watched her eyes as his conviction slowly overtook her doubts. She crossed to him, robes swishing. When she spoke, a terrible fear laced her every word.
"Then you must go now. Your father must know."
"He doesn't?"
"If he did, I would know. You do know the prophecy."
"I've never paid much attention to fear-mongering."
"Fear-mongering," she scolded. "And what if it is true? If the 49th succeeds, all Horde will be forced to drown and become albino. Our way of life will be destroyed and your father reduced to nothing."
"It's only a legend, mother. More of Bael's ranting." She grabbed his arm.
"You must tell them. Tell Kurong. They must know."
Jacob left, then, disturbed by his mother's response to the 49th. There was something refreshing about the albino he'd had in his grasp, something innocent in her way of speaking that haunted him. Overlooking the city with Bael and Kurong, Jacob pushed his mother's fear from his mind. "Look at it all," Bael said. "All that you have built and called home. How many have died among the Horde for you to possess what you do?" His father frowned. "Not so many. Our enemy would rather run and hide than face us like men." He turned to Bael. "Why do you suggest so many have died?"
"Because I know what will happen to the Horde if we fail,"
Not a house you see will be left standing. The streets will be lined with the dead, bloating under the hot sun. Kurong will be known among those who survive as the one who failed to heed Tile's warning and bowed to the lamb.
Enough!
Kurong turned from the overlook and strode into the inner sanctum. Jacob suppressed a smile and followed. He didn't relish facing off with Bael, but his father leveraged his authority with pleasure. Jacob hadn't mentioned the 49th. Perhaps Kurong's demeanor would change when he learned the truth, assuming the girl really was this 49th mystic they all feared. The high priest's feet slapped the stone behind them. Bael might be the scrawniest horde still living, but his power couldn't be doubted. His magic spells and rituals had left hundreds dead in the last year alone. Herein rested the precarious but effective balance of powers. On the one hand, his father, a good and kind man who ruled with authority. On the other, the priest of Tile, who'd spurred them to defeat their enemy many times and would surely do so again. Tile's graven image glared at them at the head of the altar, a large winged serpent coiled like a dark hooded cobra with red eyes, ready to strike. Kurong turned back at the altar used by Bael to slaughter his goats. Blood. It was all about blood for the high priest and his shiitake. Jacob hated the altar almost as much as he hated Bael.
"You will speak to me plainly," Kurong said. "No embellishments. Your grand statements may work for your priests, but I am not a priest."
Bael eyed Jacob with accusing eyes. At times Jacob wondered if the reason the high priest was so pale was because his own blood had been drained by those he served.
"As you say."
The old goat picked up one of the long jeweled daggers they used to do their business. He held the knife in his spindly fingers.
"Who holds this blade?"
Kurong's brow arched.
"This is what you call plain speech?"
"I do,"
Bael said. He flipped his wrist with surprising speed and sent the dagger toward Jacob, who watched it fly, alarmed. He caught it in the air, inches from his throat.
"And who holds it now?"
Bael asked.
"I do,"
Jacob said.
"Would you like it back the same way?"
"Few albinos wield the blade. Only we, as Horde. We have the advantage, and we have the army. But soon, very soon, that will change. We won't be the only ones wielding the sword."
"You speak of albinos as if they are something to fear,"
Kurong said.
"These weaklings you capture to study and dissect like insects in your dungeons. Even if they do take up arms, they're only a few thousand. Flies for our horses to swat off their backs. Gathered as one, my army would number over 500,000.
"Thomas of Hunter's albinos number only a few thousand, but they are not the only albinos."
"The Elianites," Jacob thought. From the far side where the young woman had come from. He'd known that Bael's summons was about his failure to bring her back, but watching the priest now, Jacob realized he might have underestimated the weightiness of the matter. Had Bael known she was the 49th?
"The Elianites have never crossed the divide,"
Kurong said.
"They have no interest in our world."
"Not today, but if she reaches them, that will change."
"Who?" Jacob interjected.
"The albino who escaped you? The one who claims to be the 49th?
Bael glared at Jacob. Kurong had gone still.
"You let the 49th mystic out of your grasp?"
his father demanded of Bael.
"You think I knew?"
the priest snapped.
"I only just learned the truth myself."
So Bael had spoken to one of Jacob's men already.
"And how can you be sure?"
Kurong asked.
because I stole her memory. And yet she now makes a claim that can only come from powers beyond this world. He paced, hands gripped tight. She is the one. I now know this in my bones.
How could you allow this?
Kurong thundered.
Are you deaf?
I didn't know.
Then what good are you to us? A prophet with no power to know the greatest threat when it arises. You should have killed her while she was in your dungeons, instead of subjecting her to all of these nonsensical tests and dissections you perform on albinos.
No, not kill. The 49th must be taken alive. If we kill any 49th, another will only rise in their place. No, she must be made to betray her kind. This much is certain. In either this world or the other, it is the only way to be done with a threat forever.
The other?
Kurong eyed him with disdain. Bael had occasionally spoken of other worlds, but neither Jacob nor his father gave such talk any mind. They were the mad ramblings of a religious fool.
I realize you don't care about other dimensions, Bael said, but you will. Indeed, her defeat in that other world will facilitate her defeat here, and vice versa. She must betray herself, either here or there.
To this end, Tile long ago dispatched Elidan to the other world to wait for her.
If the 49th doesn't betray herself, all Horde are doomed.
The prophecy. Then the lion will lie down with the lamb. Meaning the lion, all Horde, would bow to the lamb and become albino. Bael insisted that he knew this from Tile. This, Jacob could grasp. But Bael speaking of other worlds confused the matter. How could such a thing be possible?
Kurong's jaw flexed. If there is this other world, and if Tile dispatched Elidan to deal with the 49th long ago, why is there still a problem? This is the typical posturing your kind always, because the 49th only becomes the 49th at the fullness of age.
Bael interrupted. 3 sevens.
This clearly occurred only recently. Rather than question what is known, I would set my mind on correcting the failings of your son.
Jacob refused to cower.
There is no failing, he said. Only a delay.
I have talked to the men, Bael said, biting off each word. Twice she was in your grasp. Twice she slipped through. How does a frail albino without any memory escape the clutches of Jacob, son of Kurong?
It was a good question, one Jacob had been asking himself. Short of magic, he couldn't fathom how she'd managed to escape them in the darkness. The second encounter was less of a mystery. She'd proven herself to be adept with knives. He could still see her eyes as she bore down on him, blade clenched between her teeth. But her weapon flew wide, intentionally so. Why, after killing his other men so readily? Something in her eyes intrigued him.
She went east, Bael said. East, where the Elianites live. They would use her to crush us.
Now you speak sacrilege.
Kurong glared at the priest.
No albino army can crush the Horde.
None but one led by the 49th. Or do you now doubt the words of Tile?
Kurong remained silent.
I do not question your armies, my lord. Bael dipped his head. They are far superior to any other. But we cannot pretend to know more than Tile. The 49th must be taken before she falls into the hands of our enemies, or they will rise in a holy terror to enslave all Horde.
Let them try.
But Jacob heard concern in his father's voice. She's far more powerful than you realize, Bael said.
I won't let her reach the Great Divide, Jacob said, eager to move beyond the talk of superstitions.
You won't.
Bael walked up to Jacob and plucked away the dagger he'd thrown.
Because I will send Camphouse.
Camphouse, a cutthroat whose hatred for all things albino made up for his lesser skill with a blade.
Nonsense, Jacob said. My men are already saddled on fresh horses, waiting for me at the northern gate. Did you think I came back for wine and women?
He suppressed his anger.
This is the reason for your urgent summons, to cut me down in front of my father.
Kurong was lost to his own thoughts, staring out the far window.
Take additional horses, he said, facing Jacob. She has only 6 or 7 hours on you, and she'll need to rest. The divide is a full 5 days' ride, even at the best pace. She must not be allowed to reach the Elyonites. Do you understand? 49th or not, we can take no chances. She must be stopped. If you must, kill her.
Alive, Bael snapped. It's the only way to defeat the prophecy and forever bind this world to Tile.
What makes you think you can force her to betray her own?
Kurong demanded.
You've already failed to deal with her.
Bael ignored the slight, jaw firm.
He will force her hand.
He? Kurong searched the priest's eyes.
The one sent by Tile into this other world you speak of? Yes. Together, we cannot fail. She will betray her own, but not if she slips our grasp.
Fine. Take her alive. But if you can't, kill her before the Elyonites take her.
Am I clear?
They won't reach the divide, Jacob said, walking for the door.
They?
Bael turned.
There is more than one?
Jacob turned back.
Didn't my men tell you?
We found the tracks of a third albino at the oasis.
She rides east with him.
This seemed to puzzle Bael, but he brushed his concern away.
You must take her, he said.
Jacob stared him down for a moment, then headed out.
Of course. Alive and subdued for your sharp little daggers.
Chapter 12. It was amazing how only a few short words could completely change a person's perspective, David thought. How just one strand of code could alter a program. How switching one gene on or off could modify an entire organism's expression. Vlad Smith was right about one thing. All organism was algorithm. But those weren't the words that had short-circuited David's brain. Vlad's other statement had done that trick.
Your wife was murdered.
He didn't believe the man, naturally. Not fully and completely. He'd made that much clear to Rochelle after trying and failing to track down Vlad only minutes after he'd left. David didn't believe. But he did. At the very least, that something about his wife's death didn't make sense. For years he'd blamed himself after her death, but now a door had been kicked open to another possibility. One that was much darker than any he could have imagined. He knew this was just how the mind got people into trouble. But that didn't stop his mind from trying to get him into trouble. The mere suggestion of something afoul was enough to set gears in motion, and once they were churning, their momentum took on a life of its own. Years of guilt, anger, and self-condemnation had created new neural pathways in his brain. As they said, neurons that fire together, wire together. Those well-worn ruts in his frontal lobe had accepted and embraced the new content Vlad had supplied. namely that his wife had been murdered because she was special, like their daughter, which David knew to be true. The man might be onto something. He'd also been onto something in implying that this information wasn't something David could just throw in Simon's face, true or not. Regardless of whether Simon knew anything, he would immediately pull Barth in. And Barth wasn't the kind of man you could question or cross without consequence. David let it all stew, knowing he was feeding his own fear and anger without being able to set the accusations aside. He would have dismissed the matter altogether, but he didn't have that kind of control over his mind. Truth was, Rochelle was more practiced in the disciplines of dealing with fear. There was more to consider, of course. For starters, how Rochelle had managed to catch the apple Smith had thrown at her with enough speed to strike out most ballplayers, without the slightest warning. Then there was the book Smith had pulled out. Rochelle was concerned about how her mother may have died, but she feared something far more ominous was happening, and right now, not just back then. She tried to explain that her dreams were more than just her way of working through her blindness. Even if she was right, which he doubted, it all stemmed from his wife's death. After an hour, David told Rochelle to stay put. He was going to the hospital to clear his mind. Maybe Miranda would have some ideas.
Ideas about what?
Rochelle asked.
A clinical perspective. If your mother was murdered, we should be able to find evidence.
What evidence? That was 16 years ago.
We never did an autopsy. Maybe exhume her body.
No, not that. Even if you find some evidence, Simon will have an explanation.
She had a point.
Let it go, Dad. At least for the next 5 days.
Why 5?
Because Vlad told you 6 days, which now leaves 5.
He'd forgotten about Smith's claim that the world as they knew it would end in 6 days. That was yesterday. He looked at his daughter pacing, biting on a fingernail. The young girl who'd bounced around the town only yesterday, proclaiming her sight to the world, had been stolen and replaced by a young woman who believed the fate of the world rested on her shoulders. He had no desire to feed her paranoia. She was already obsessed. He had his own obsession to deal with. He caught himself. No, that wasn't true.
Okay, I'll let it go, he said. But I'm going to talk to Miranda. Promise me you'll stay put. If Smith wanted to harm either of us, he's had plenty of opportunity. But I don't want you taking any chances.
Chances? Like accusing Barth of murder? She said.
He nodded.
Yes, chances like that. I got it.
But he hadn't really gotten it, because his mind was screaming past its hopeless attempt at denial. Even knowing this, he felt powerless against it. He turned his back and headed for the door.
Dad?
Yeah?
What begins as white, that man has made black?
He thought a moment. A riddle.
I have no idea. But I do know what's black and white and red all over.
What's that?
A skunk in a blender.
Rochelle nodded, but he doubted she'd even heard him.
If I'm not here, I'll be at the pasture, she said. I need some air.
Okay, but nowhere else.
He found Miranda at the hospital with RG, but it took him a while to work through how to tell them what Smith had done and said. He finally just laid it out for them exactly as he understood it himself.
Well, what do you think? He asked.
Sounds like someone wants to stir up trouble so he can sell his snake oil,
RG said.
I don't know.
Miranda was more reluctant.
There could be some truth to it. The mind's more powerful than we know.
Exactly.
David stood and crossed to the window. The question is why?
What was so threatening about my wife?
No, not the part about your wife, Miranda said. I agree with R.G. Smith's just stirring up trouble. Ignore it.
That put him back. Then exactly which part makes sense to you? The part about my daughter dreaming of white bats? Or the part where she has to save the world?
Those are just dreams. But even snake oil can work if the salesman does his job and gets a susceptible customer to believe.
She was out when he pricked her finger.
True, R.G. said. But our subconscious mind hears and registers everything around us while we're sleeping. David knew that. He also knew that they weren't going to bite. Miranda had hopes of replacing his wife and wanted nothing to do with an investigation into how she'd died. She definitely wouldn't jump at the idea of exhuming her body. And R.G., well, R.G. was too logical to think past what was right in front of him. It was nearly 4 o'clock in the afternoon before David made the decision that he would talk to Simon. He simply had to, if not for his own sake, then out of respect for his wife. He wouldn't go in hurling accusations, which would endanger them all. Instead, he'd speak to Simon without even mentioning his wife. He'd win the judge's confidence by dutifully reporting the danger that Smith presented in throwing out wild suggestions that the residents of Eden were somehow being manipulated. He would watch the man like a hawk. Simon had balked when Rochelle asked if something was wrong with Eden. How would he react to more pointed insinuations? But he wouldn't mention his wife. Not yet. David told Miranda and R.G. that he had to check in on Rochelle. Then he slipped out a side door, in no mood to talk to Sue at the front. He walked quickly, head down, hands in pockets, straight for the council chambers, hoping Simon would be there monitoring outside news on the ham radio, assuming the satellite feed wasn't back online. Funny, he'd hardly thought about the grid crisis all day. The world was in a nosedive out there, and he hardly cared. There would be plenty of time for that later. It only took him a few minutes to reach the back entrance to the administration office. He climbed the 4 wooden steps to the porch and put his hand on the knob, then hesitated. He released the handle and ran his fingers through his hair, rehearsing his act one more time. Maybe he should just come out with it. Only way to really know. Maybe Simon would agree not to share any details with Barth. Or maybe he...
David?
He spun around. Hillary Moses stood on the gravel walkway, holding the hand of her youngest, Karina.
You need something?
David hesitated. Well, I just wanted to talk to Simon for a second.
You haven't heard?
Heard what?
Terrorists detonated EMPs over Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Salt Lake City. ISIS, they say.
He stood still, dumbstruck. Electromagnetic pulse blasts?
Large enough to shut down the West Coast and disable all electronic devices in 100-mile radius around each city.
When?
Simon just heard it on the ham radio half an hour ago. Mommy, can we go?
Karina was tugging on Hillary's arm.
Just a moment, sweetie.
Hillary smoothed the blonde curls of the 7-year-old. She looked back up.
Sorry, we were on the way to get some ice cream. I don't think any of this should affect the children.
No, he heard himself say. No, of course not.
Simon's off the grid.
She caught her own pun and grinned.
So to speak. Says he needs to get his ducks in a row for the meeting tonight.
The town hall meeting. He'd forgotten. What time again?
She glanced at her watch. 2 hours. 6 o'clock. I thought you knew.
Yeah, sorry. I'm...